Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
At some point during his time in a maximum security prison, according to the appeal, Richard Allen told his psychiatrist that he had shot
the victims, the girls.
Libby German and Abby Williams were not shot. They were killed with a blade. Any person who had actually committed these murders would know that. According to the defense's brief, Richard Allen did not. That detail sits at the center of everything you are about to hear. Yes, it's time to do another deep dive into Delphi, shall we? Join me and press subscribe wherever you're listening. And give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we go into one of the largest miscarriage of justice stories that we've ever covered. Because the Indiana Attorney General just filed the state's formal response to the appeal, and they describe the evidence in the case as, and I'm quoting directly from that document, conclusive and irrefutable. They want the Indiana Court of Appeals to leave Richard Allen's conviction exactly where it is, untouched for 130 years. And I tell you what, with a little bit of help from you, we're not going to let them do that. We're going to go through what they actually argue, and we're going to show you where it falls apart. Before we get into it, here's the frame. The state's response brief is the prosecution's formal rebuttal to every argument Allen's defense raised on appeal. Three major challenges are on the table. The search warrant that led to the gun and the bullet evidence was built on false or misleading statements. The confessions Allen made during 13 months of restrictive housing, that's a way to put it. He was in solitary confinement in a small box, not convicted of a crime. Is this supposed to be somebody supposed to be in county jail? He's in the darkest, most difficult, scary place for a human being to live. It's been legislated against. Even in Indiana, it's been legislated against leaving someone in there for more than 30 days, 60 days. It's a small window. They did 13 because why not? Because it's a suggestion over here. It's not technically a law. Oh, it is a law. Oh, we don't care. There's no accountability. We can do whatever the fuck we want. At least that's how it seems to be in Indiana. Can't solve a case? Now let's blame it on this guy and then railroad him and hope nobody pays attention. Our local media is shit. Oh, wait, what the hell's this? There's all these podcasters, all these independent journalists that are doing an actual job. The confessions Allen made during 13 months of being in the hole were the product of a broken mind, not a reliable memory. And the jury was systematically blocked from hearing evidence that could have changed the outcome. The state's answer to all three of those follows the same playbook. Either the issue was waived at trial, or it doesn't matter because the evidence of guilt was so overwhelming that nothing would have changed the verdict anyway, except there's no overwhelming evidence of guilt. There's a legal term for that second argument, harmless error. The state uses it like wallpaper throughout their response to the document that we're going to be going through here, and it will become important. One more thing before we go in. Allen's defense now has roughly 2 weeks to respond to the state's brief, and of course we'll bring that to you. The appeal is still moving, and the man at the center of it is serving his sentence in a prison in Oklahoma, transferred there from Indiana for his own safety, quote unquote. That's where things stand. And there's 1,000 issues with that as well. As we go through this, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Let's talk about the warrant. The state's opening move on the search of Allen's home is procedural. Allen's lawyer said no objection at the trial when the gun and bullet evidence came in. So the state says, waived, can't raise it now. Set that aside. The underlying facts, don't move with it. Betsy Blair was on the Monon High Bridge Trail the afternoon Abby and Libby were killed. She saw the man known as Bridge Guy from roughly 50 feet away. She went to a sketch artist 3 days after the murders and described him, a young male in his 20s, curly, poofy brown hair, boyish face. She rated the composite sketch a 10 out of 10 for accuracy. Richard Allen was 44 years old. With closely cropped hair, the jury never saw the sketch. They never got to hold it up next to the man sitting at the defense table and decide what they thought. The state's response is that since Blair never made a formal identification of Allen, the sketch was irrelevant and potentially misleading to the jury. But that's exactly backwards. A witness who was on the bridge produced a sketch she called perfect, and it doesn't look like the defendant. The state didn't explain the discrepancy. Their answer was to make sure the jury never had to confront it. Now the confessions. And here's where the state's brief becomes genuinely difficult to read. The defense argues that 13 months in restrictive housing at maximum security prison or at a maximum security prison as a man who had not yet been convicted of anything systematically destroyed Richard Allen's mental health, and that the confessions that followed were the product of a psychotic episode, not memory. The state's rebuttal is to itemize his cell amenities. He had a mattress and a bed frame, a tablet, showered 3 times a week, a window. He was offered a television and declined. What the state's brief does not linger on is what the defense's documented record actually shows. According to the appellant's brief, Allen was found gravely disabled. He was involuntarily injected with antipsychotic medication because his deterioration had become so severe the prison couldn't wait for consent. He lost more than 40 pounds. He was drinking toilet water. Guards documented behavior so severe and so disturbing that the prison's own records read like something from a different century. He asked his psychiatrist if he was dead. On one phone call with his family, he told him, or told them, he believed the prison was poisoning him and compared his situation to Guantanamo Bay. He confessed to crimes against his own family members, confessions those family members went into court and denied ever happened because they didn't. He was delusionally confessing to crimes that didn't exist. 2 days after confessing to Dr. Walla, he asked her whether he had said anything because he didn't remember. And at multiple points during those confessions, according to the defense's brief, he told people that he had taken a gun, a weapon like that, and took the girls out with that. However, that's not how they died. He did not shoot the girls. The state's 94-page response does not address that specific detail, not once. What they argue instead is that Allen began confessing before his psychosis formally peaked in early April and kept confessing after it and cleared in May, and therefore the confessions aren't tied to the breakdown. They offer two alternative explanations for why he started talking. He received his legal discovery at the end of March and had to face the evidence for the first time, and he had found religion in late March. But a new convert's desire to confess his sins may have driven what followed, except none of that is true. Both of those explanations are plausible on their surface, but neither one accounts for a man confessing to a crime and getting the manner of death wrong. That's not a man confessing from memory, that's something else entirely, and the state never explains what. And there's evidence the jury never got to hear. And this is where I want you to hold one question in your head the whole time, not whether any individual ruling was defensible, but what it means that they all went in the same direction. The jury didn't hear from Betsy Blair about the composite sketch. We talked about that. They also didn't hear from William Tobin, an expert who would have challenged the scientific validity of the methodology used to link the bullet to Allen's gun. excluded because the court ruled he wasn't qualified in that specific sub-discipline, even as the defense's own firearms experts testified that the methodology was completely contested. They saw 15 videos of Allen's movement through the prison during the months he was confessing, and they watched those videos muted. The audio was excluded as hearsay. So they could see a man in obvious deterioration without ever hearing what he was saying. Two of three phone calls Allen made in April 3rd, calls where he told people he was losing his mind, that he was confused, that he questioned the reality of his own statements. Those were blocked because the court ruled the one call the state already admitted was complete enough on its own. Really, it means it contradicts their theory because it's complete enough on its own, right? Don't hear that. Shut your ears. Don't listen to real evidence. Let's just not give it to him, Judge. Okay. The jury heard the confession call. They didn't hear the calls around it that showed the state of the mind making it, and they just pretend there was nothing there. They heard nothing, not a word. About a year-long investigation into whether those murders were part of a ritual killing, an investigation law enforcement ran themselves. Within a week of those girls being found, the Carroll County Sheriff had already asked the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit to look at the sticks placed on their bodies and evaluate whether they were connected to pagan rituals. All of that existed. Investigators pursued it for years. The jury was told none of it. Sounds like a fair trial, doesn't it? Every one of those rulings may be legally defensible, standing alone, but every single one of them cut in the same direction. Every one of them took something away from the defense and gave nothing back. The jury got one picture of what happened in those woods, and they were told that picture was complete. The question the Court of Appeals now has to answer is whether that was fair, as a fair trial, or a managed one. Let's talk about the van. This is the state's most important argument, so I want to be precise. In his May 3rd confession to Dr. Walla, the one the state emphasized came after Allen's period of psychosis and formally cleared, even though he wasn't, Allen described seeing a van drive past while he had the girls. Seeing that van, he said, scared him and changed his plans. Investigators traced that detail to Brad Weber, a man who drove his white cargo van home from the Subaru plant in Lafayette that afternoon. The prosecution told the jury that was the detail only the killer would know. It became a centerpiece of closing arguments. Here's what the state's brief says about the defendant's challenge to Weber's timeline, that Allen's attorneys failed to provide proper verification of the surveillance video timestamp, and that timestamps on security cameras are often inaccurate. The Hoosier Harvestone camera, they note, was running 54 minutes fast. It's a fair point. Timestamps can fail. But the defense wasn't relying solely on one neighbor's camera. They also cited FBI cell phone analysis placing Weber's phone arriving home significantly later than Weber's own testimony suggested. The state's answer to that, Allen offered no proper evidentiary foundation for the FBI data at trial. That may be procedurally accurate, but here's what it actually means in plain language. The state is not saying the FBI analysis is wrong. They're saying it wasn't introduced with the correct paperwork. The underlying timeline problem still exists outside the courtroom. Libby's phone showed movement stopping at 2:32 in the afternoon. The surveillance footage the defense obtained showed the van pulling towards that delivery or that driveway around 2:44. The FBI phone data pointed even later. If the van arrived after the phone had already stopped moving, after everything was already done, then Allen's description of seeing a van and being scared isn't the detail only the killer would know. It's the detail that doesn't match the timeline, and it doesn't match in the state's central argument for why we should trust the confession that it's resting on testimony that their own suppressed evidence calls into question. Which brings us all the way back to harmless error. That phrase does an enormous amount of lifting in this document. Every ruling that heard Allen's defense gets the same conclusion attached to it. Doesn't matter. Jury would have convicted him anyway. The evidence is overwhelming. That argument only holds if every pillar of the case is solid. a bullet comparison that, according to trial testimony documented in the appeal, initially came back without a match before a different methodology was applied, and they called it the original methodology. That's very much in question of being legitimate in any way, shape, or form. Confessions from a man who was found gravely disabled, who got the cause of death wrong, who confessed to things his own family members have said never happened. A corroborating detail, the van tied to the timeline that the state's own evidence appears to undermine. A sketch rated perfect by the woman who made it that the jury never got to see, that looks nothing like Richard Allen. If any one of those things was a crack in it, harmless error isn't a legal doctrine. It's the thing you say when you don't want to answer the question. Allen's defense will file a reply brief. Three appellate judges will eventually decide whether this trial met the constitutional standard, not whether Allen is guilty, but whether the process that convicted him was sound. That's the question on the table right now. The state says it was. They say everything was done right. They say a man exercised his free will and told the truth. But somewhere in the record of this case, there's a man asking his doctor if he's dead, saying he shot two people who were actually killed with a blade, and is being called a voluntary confession as being a credible witness to his own crime. Even though that timeline and his story make no sense, because he was in an active state of psychosis when he gave it. The state spent 94 pages explaining why that's acceptable. They never explain why he got it wrong. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. This is, I mean, if you're just diving into this, there are so many details that it'd be impossible to cover here in this one piece. That's why we've already done hundreds of them. So if you look back in our archive here on the Hidden Killers podcast or on our YouTube channel, just type in Delphi on our channel. You'll be pleasantly surprised that there are literally hundreds of videos to help inform you and educate you on the topics. If you want to dive into this, it's there. Oh, my friends, it is there. We'll be diving deeper into this week with Bob Mata, defense attorney, and discussing what the next steps are, what all this means in greater detail from a defense attorney standpoint. So be sure to join us for that. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. We'll continue the conversation in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.